What will the Emperor do without you around, Reverend Mother? He relies on you to learn who lies and who tells the truth. You're no ordinary truth-sayer by any historical measure. Beside her, soothed by the massage cycle, Lobbia fell asleep. As she relaxed, Anirul pondered layers of secrecy within the sisterhood, the strict compartmentalization of information. The dozing truth-sayer beside her was one of the most powerful women in the Imperium. But even Lobbia didn't know the true nature of Anirul's duties, knew very little, in fact, about the Kwisatz Haderach program. On the other side of the underground pool chambers, Anirul watched her husband, Shaddam, emerge from a steam room, dripping and wrapped in a Carthan towel. Before the door closed, she saw his companions, two naked concubines from the royal harem. The women had all begun to look alike to her, even with her Bene Gesserit powers of observation. Shaddam didn't have much of a sexual appetite for Anirul, though she certainly knew techniques to please him. In accordance with the Mother Superior's command, she had recently delivered a fourth daughter to him, Josepha. He had grown more furious with each girl child, and now he turned to concubines and ignored her. Realizing that Shaddam lived under the ponderous weight of Elrud's long reign, Anirul wondered if her husband dallied with so many concubines because he was trying to compete with his father's ghost. Was he keeping score? As the Emperor walked pompously from the steam room toward one of the cold pools, he turned away from his wife and dove in with a small splash. Surfacing, he stroked efficiently toward the water lanes. He liked to swim the palace perimeter at least 10 times a day. She wished Shaddam paid as much attention to running the Imperium as he did to his own diversions. Occasionally, Anirul tested him in subtle ways, and found that he knew far less than she did about the interfamilial alliances and manipulations around him. A grave gap in his knowledge. Shaddam had been increasing the ranks of his Sardaukar corps, though not enough, and without any overall plan. He liked to style himself as a soldier, and even wore the uniform. But he didn't have the edge, the military vision, or the talent for moving his toy soldiers around the universe in a productive manner. Hearing a high-pitched squeal, Anirul saw a tiny black shape in the stone rafters above the waterways. With a fluttering of wings, a Distran's bat swooped toward her with yet another message from Wallach 9. The tiny creature had been transported and set free on Kaitain, where it had homed in on her. Old Lobbia didn't stir, and Anirul knew Shaddam wouldn't return for at least half an hour. She was alone. Adjusting her vocal cords, the Kwisatz mother matched the cry of the bat. It swooped down and landed on her damp, upturned palms. She stared at its ugly muzzle, the sharp teeth, the eyes like tiny black pearls. Focusing her attention, Anirul emitted another squeak, and the bat responded with a staccato chitter, a burst of compact signals encoded on the nervous system of the rodent messenger. Hearing this, Anirul slowed it down in her mind. Even truth-sayer Lobbia didn't know the code. The high-pitched tone became a series of clicks and bursts, which she translated and sorted. It was a report from Mother Superior Harishka, updating her on the culmination of 90 generations of careful genetic planning. Sister Jessica, the secret daughter of Gaius Helen Mohiam and Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, remained unsuccessful in her sacred mission to bear an Atreides' daughter. Was she refusing, delaying intentionally? Mohiam had said the young girl was spirited, loyal, but occasionally stubborn. Anirul had expected the next daughter in the genetic path to be conceived by now, the penultimate child who would be mother to their secret weapon. Yet for some time Jessica had been sleeping with Duke Leto Atreides, but still she had not become pregnant. Intentional on her part? The attractive young woman had tested as fertile, and she was an adept seductress. Duke Leto Atreides had already sired one son. What is taking her so long? Not good news. If the long-awaited Harkonnen Atreides' daughter was not born soon, Mother Superior would summon Jessica back to Wallach 9 and find out why. Anirul considered letting the bat fly free, but decided not to risk it. With a clench of her fingers, she broke the creature's fragile neck and disposed of the winged carcass in a matter recycler behind the pool chamber. Leaving Lobia to sleep in her massage chair, Anirul hurried back upstairs into the palace. "You carve wounds upon my flesh, and write their insult," Freeman lament. Despite the fact that Leet Kynes had no medicines other than a simple first aid pack in his Frem kit, Warwick survived. Blinded by grief and guilt, Leet lashed the near-dead man high onto the back of a worm. During the long journey back to the siege, Leet shared his own water, did his best to repair Warwick's ravaged stillsuit. Within Redwall Siege there was much wailing and weeping. Farula, who had considerable skill in the uses of healing herbs, never left her husband's side. She tended him hour after hour as he lay in a blind stupor, clinging to the threads of life. Though his face was bandaged, Warwick's skin could never regrow. Leet had heard that the genetic wizards of the Bene Tlaelacs could create new eyes, new limbs, new flesh. But the Freeman would never accept such a healing miracle, not even for one of their own. Already the Siege Elders and fearful children made warding signs near the curtain hangings of Warwick's chambers, as if to fend off an ugly demon. Hynar, the old one-eyed Naib, came to see his disfigured son-in-law. Kneeling beside her husband's pallet, Farula looked stricken. Her elfin face, once so quick to flash a smile or snap a witty retort, was now drawn. Her intense and curious eyes were wide with helplessness. Though Warwick had not died, she wore a yellow Nejoni scarf, the color of mourning. Proud and grieving, the Naib called a council of Siege Elders, at which Leet Kynes told the stern men exactly what had happened, giving his testament so that the freemen could understand and honor the great sacrifice Warwick had made. The young man should have been considered a hero. Poems should have been written and honorific songs sung about him. But Warwick had made one terrible mistake. He had not died when he should have. Hynar and the council somberly made preparations for a freeman funeral. It was only a matter of time, they said. The mutilated man could not possibly survive. Nonetheless, he did. Covered with salves, Warwick's wounds stopped bleeding. Farula fed him, often with Leet looking on, desperately wishing he could do something helpful. But even the son of Umma Kynes could not perform the miracle his friend needed. Warwick's son, Leet Chi, too young to understand, remained in the care of his mourning grandparents. Though Warwick looked like a half-rotted carcass, there was no smell of infection about him, no yellowish suppuration of wounds, no gangrene. In a most curious manner he was healing, leaving patches of exposed bone. His staring, lidless eyes could never close in a peaceful sleep, though the night of blindness was always with him. Standing with Farula in the midst of her vigil, Leet whispered to his friend, telling stories of Seleucia Secundus, recalling the times the two had raided Harkonnen troops, when they had acted as bait to kill the enemy scouts who'd poisoned the wells of Belar camp. Still Warwick lay unmoving, day after day, hour after hour. Farula bowed her head and said in a voice that barely managed to escape her throat, "What have we done to offend Shai-Hulud? Why are we punished like this?" During the heavy silence in which Leet tried to find an answer for her, Warwick stirred on the pallet. Farula gasped and took a half-step back. Then her husband sat up. His lidless eyes flickered, as if focusing on the far wall. And he spoke, moving the sinews that held his jaws together. His teeth and his corrugated tongue stirred, forming harsh words.
"I have seen a vision,"
Now I understand what I must do. For days Warwick shambled, slow but determined, through the passageways of the siege. Blinded by the sand, he found his way by touch, seeing with inner mystical eyes. Keeping to the shadows, he looked like a mockery of a corpse. He spoke in a low, papery voice, but his words had a compelling edge. People wanted to run, but could not tear themselves away, as he intoned.
When I was engulfed by the storm, at the moment I should have encountered death, a voice whispered to me from the sand-laden wind. It was Shai Hulud himself, telling me why I must endure this tribulation.
Varula, still wearing yellow, tried to drag her husband back to their quarters. Though the freemen avoided speaking to him, they were drawn to listen. If ever a man could receive a holy vision, might it not be Warwick, after what he had endured in the maw of a storm? Was it just a coincidence that he had lived through what no other man had ever survived? Or did it prove that Shai Hulud had plans for him, a thread in a cosmic tapestry? If ever they had seen a man touched by the fiery finger of God, Warwick was such a one. Staring ahead, he walked compulsively into the chambers where Hainar sat on a mat with the Council of Elders. The freeman fell silent, unsure how to respond. Warwick stood just inside the chamber doorway.
"You must drown a maker," he said. "Call the Sayyidina, and have her witness the ceremony of the Water of Life. I must transform it, so that I may proceed with my work."
He turned away with his shuffling gait, leaving Hainar and his companions appalled and confused. No man had ever taken the Water of Life and survived. It was a substance for reverend mothers, a magical, poisonous concoction that was fatal to anyone not prepared. Unswerving, Warwick walked into a common chamber where adolescents trampled raw spice in tubs. Unmarried women curded melange distillate for the production of plastics and fuel. Against the walls, the whing and slap of a power loom made a hypnotic rhythm. Other freemen labored meticulously on still suits, repairing and checking the intricate mechanisms. Solar-powered cook stoves heated a healthy gruel and mash, which the siege members ate for a light midday meal. Larger feasts occurred only after sundown, when dusk had cooled the desert. An old man with a nasal voice sang a sad lament, recounting the centuries of aimless journeys the Zensuni had endured before finally arriving on the desert planet. Leetkynes sat listlessly with two of Stilgar's guerrilla fighters drinking spice coffee. All activity stopped when Warwick arrived and began to talk.
"I have seen a green dune, a paradise. Even Amakynes does not know the grandeur that Shai Hulud revealed to me."
His voice was like a cold wind through an open cave.
"I have heard the voice from the outer world. I have had a vision of the Lisan al-Ghaib, for whom we have waited. I have seen the way, as promised by legend, as promised by the Sayyidina."
The freeman murmured at his audacity. They had heard the prophecy, knew that such a one was foretold. The reverend mothers had taught it for centuries, and legend had passed from tribe to tribe, generation to generation. The freemen had waited so long that some were skeptical, but others were convinced and fearful.
"I must drink the Water of Life. I have seen the path."
Leet led his friend away from the communal chamber, back to his own rooms, where Ferula sat talking with her father. Looking up at her husband as he entered, her face was drawn with resignation and her eyes red with weeks of tears. On a carpet nearby, her baby son began to cry. Seeing Warwick and Leet together, the old Naib turned back to his daughter.
"This is as it must be, Ferula," Hainar said. "The elders have decided. It is a tremendous sacrifice, but if... If he is the one, if he is truly the Lisan al-Ghaib, we must do as he says. We will give him the water of life. Leet and Farula both tried to talk Warwick out of his obsession, but the scarred man persisted in his belief. He stared with lidless eyes, but could not meet their gaze.
It is my Mashhad
and my Mina, my spiritual test and my religious test. How do you know it wasn't just strange sounds you heard in the wind? Leet insisted. Warwick, how do you know you're not being deceived?
Because I know.
And in the beatific face of his conviction, they had no choice but to believe him. Old Reverend Mother Romalo journeyed from a distant Seech to preside over the ceremony, to prepare. Freeman men took their captive small worm, only 10 meters in length, and wrestled it down, drowning it in water taken from a kanat. As the worm died and exhaled its poisonous bile, the freeman gathered the liquid into a flexible jug and prepared it for the ceremony. In the midst of the commotion, planetologist Kynes returned from his plantings, but was so focused on his own concerns that he did not grasp the significance of the event, only that it was important. He voiced awkward apologies to his son, expressing sadness over what had happened to Warwick. But Leet could see that planet-scale calculations and assessments continued in the back of his mind. His terraforming project could not rest for one moment, not even for the chance that Warwick might be the long-foretold messiah who would unify the Freeman into a fighting force. The population of Red Wall Seech gathered in their huge meeting chamber. High above, on the open platform where Hynar addressed his tribe, Warwick stepped forth. The disfigured man was accompanied by the Naib and the powerful Sayyadina, who had served these people for several generations. Old Romalo looked as toughened and hard as a desert lizard who would hold her own against a hunting hawk. The Sayyadina summoned the watermasters and intoned the ritual words. The freeman repeated them, but with a greater anxiety than usual. Some truly believed Warwick was everything he claimed to be. Others could do no more than hope. Murmurs filled the chamber. Under normal circumstances, partaking in the Tau orgy was a joyous event, celebrated only at times of great import. After a victory against Harkonnens, or the discovery of a huge spice deposit, or surviving a natural disaster. This time, though, the freemen knew what was at stake. They looked at the mutilated face of Warwick as he stood, impassive and determined. They watched with hope and fear, wondering if he would change their lives, or fail horribly, as had other men in generations past. In the audience, Leet stood beside Farula and her baby, observing from the foremost tiers. Her lips were tight in a tense frown, her eyes closed in fearful anticipation. Leet could sense fear radiating from her, and he wanted to comfort her. Was she afraid that the poison would kill her husband? Or rather afraid that he might survive and continue his painful daily life? Sayyadina Romalo finished her benediction and handed the flask to Warwick. Let Shai-Hulud judge now if your vision is true, if you are the Lisan al-Ghaib, whom we have sought for so long.
I have seen the Lisan al-Ghaib, Warwick said, then lowered his voice so that only the old woman could hear. I did not say it was me.
The exposed bones and tendons on Warwick's hands moved as he grasped the flexible nozzle and tilted it toward his lips. Romalo squeezed the sides of the bag, squirting a gush of poison into Warwick's mouth. He swallowed convulsively, then swallowed again. The Freeman audience fell silent, a humming mass of humanity who tried to comprehend. Leet thought he could hear their hearts beating in unison. He experienced the whisper of each indrawn breath, sensed the blood pounding in his own ears. He waited and watched.
The hawk and the mouse are the same, Warwick said.
peering into the future. Within moments, the water of life began to do its work. All of Warwick's previous suffering, all the terrible anguish he had endured in the storm and afterward, were only prelude to the horrific death that awaited him. The poison pervaded the cells of his body, setting them afire. The Freeman believed that the disfigured man's spiritual vision had deluded him. He raved and thrashed. "They do not know what they have created. Born of water, dies in sand." Sayedina Romalo stepped back, like a predatory bird seeing prey turn on her. "What does this mean?"
"They think they can control him, but they are deluded."
She chose her words carefully, interpreting them through her ancient, half-forgotten filter of the Panoplia Propheticus.
"He says he can see where others cannot. He has seen the way."
"Lisan al-Ghaib, he will be everything we dreamed."
Warwick retched so hard that his ribs cracked like kindling. Blood came from his mouth.
"But nothing like we expected."
The Sayedina raised her claw-like hands.
"He has seen the Lisan al-Ghaib. He is coming, and he will be everything we dreamed."
Warwick screamed until he had no more voice to utter a sound, twitched and kicked and thrashed, until he had no more muscle control, until his brain was eaten away. The villagers of Belark camp had consumed heavily diluted water of life, and had still died in terrible agony. For Warwick, even such an insane death would have been a mercy.
"The hawk and the mouse are the same."
Unable to help him, the Freeman could only watch in appalled dismay. Warwick's death convulsions lasted for hours and hours, but Romalo took far longer to interpret the disturbing visions he had seen. The stone is heavy and the sand weighty, but a fool's wrath is heavier than them both. Duke Leto Atreides. When a grim and unsettled Dominic Bernius returned to the polar base on Arrakis, his men rushed to greet him. Seeing the man's expression, though, they knew their leader did not bear welcome news. Under the bald pate and heavy brow, his eyes were haunted, deep set in shadowed hollows. His once bronzed skin had aged prematurely, as if all the color and spirit had been scrubbed from him, leaving him with only an iron will. His last thread of hope had been severed, and now vengeance burned in his gaze. Bundled in a heavy sin fur coat open at the front to reveal his mat of white chest hair, the veteran Asuyo stood on the landing platform, his expression lined with concern. He scratched his bristly shock of hair.
"What is it, Dom? What's happened, eh?"
Dominic Vernius just stared at the towering walls of the crevasse that rose like a fortress around him.
"I have seen things no Ixion should have to witness. My beloved world is as dead as my wife."
In a daze, he walked from his empty ship into the warren of passages that his men had drilled into the frozen walls. More smugglers greeted him, asked him for tidings. But he continued without answering. In confusion, the men whispered. Aimless, Dominic wandered from one passage to another. He trailed his fingertips along the polymer-sealed walls, imagining the caves of Ix. Coming to a stop, he drew a deep breath and let his gaze fall half-closed. Through sheer force of will, he tried to summon the glory of House Vernius behind his eyelids, the wonders of the underground city of Vernii, the Grand Palais, the inverted stalactite buildings of crystalline architecture. Despite centuries of fierce competition from Richies, Ixians had been the undisputed masters of technology and innovation. But in only a few years, the Tleilaxu had gutted those accomplishments, closed access to Ix, even driven off the Guild Bank, causing financiers to deal through off-world headquarters of Tleilaxu choosing.
In his prime, during the revolt on Ekaz, Dominic Vernius had given everything for his emperor. He'd fought and sweated and bled to defend Carino honor. So long ago, as if in another lifetime. Back then, the Akazi separatists had seemed to be misguided dreamers, violent yet naive guerrillas who needed to be crushed into submission, lest they set a bad precedent for other uneasy worlds in the Galactic Imperium. Dominic had lost many good men in those struggles. He had buried comrades. He had seen the painful deaths of soldiers who followed his orders into battle. He remembered rushing across the stubbled field of a burned forest beside Jodam's brother, a brave and fast-thinking man. Yelling, weapons pointed ahead, they had fired into the nest of resistance fighters. Jodam's brother had dropped to the ground. Dominic thought he'd tripped on a blackened root, but when he bent to pull the other man to his feet, he found only a smoldering neck stump from a photonic artillery blast. Dominic had won the battle that day, at the cost of nearly a third of his men. His troops had succeeded in wiping out the Akazi rebels, and for that, he had received accolades. The fallen soldiers had received mass graves on a planet far from their homes. The Carinos did not deserve such sacrifices. The Chom directorship of House Vernius had been expanded because of his great deeds. At the victory celebrations, with a very young Archduke Ekaz seated once again on the mahogany throne, he'd been a revered guest on Kytane. At Elrud's side, Dominic had strolled through halls brimming with crystal, precious metals, and polished woods. He'd sat at feasting tables that seemed to stretch for kilometers, while crowds outside cheered his name. He'd stood proudly below the Golden Lion throne while the Emperor presented him with a Medal of Valor and other medals for his lieutenants. Dominic had emerged as a famous hero from those battles, earning the undying loyalty of his men, as they had shown him for years now, even here in this squalid place. No, the Carinos deserved none of that.
"What are you thinking, Dominic?"
The voice seemed to whisper in his head, a soft, musical tone that was oddly familiar, yet nearly forgotten.
"Shando. But it could not be."
"What are you thinking, Dominic?" What I saw on Ix drove away the last vestiges of my fear. "It killed my restraint," he said aloud, but in a quiet voice so that no one heard him. No one but the ethereal presence of his lovely lady. "I've decided to do something, my love. Something I should have done 20 years ago. In the months-long Antarctic day, Dominic did not mark the passage of hours or weeks on his chronometer. Shortly after he returned from Ix, with plans formed like stone sculptures in his mind, he went out alone. Dressed in worker's clothes, he requested an audience with the water merchant, Rondo Tuic. The smugglers paid handsomely for Tuic's silence every month, and the industrial baron arranged secret connections with the guild for transport to other worlds. Dominic had never been interested in turning a profit, and only stole salaries from the imperial treasury in order to sabotage the Carino name. So he'd never regretted paying the bribes. He spent what was necessary to do what he needed to do. None of the off-worlders at the water processing factory recognized him, though some gave Dominic disapproving glances when he strode into the complex and insisted on seeing the water merchant. Tuic recognized him, but did not manage to cover his expression of shock. "It's been years since you've shown your face here." "I need your help," Dominic said. "I want to purchase more services." Rondo Tuic smiled, his wide-set eyes glimmering. He scratched the thick tuft of hair on the left side of his head. "Always happy to sell." He gestured to a corridor. "This way, please." As they rounded a bend, Dominic saw a man approaching. His heavy white parka was open at the front, and he carried a plexfile pack, which he flipped through as he walked. He had his head down. "Lingar Butte,"
Tuik said, his tone bemused. Watch out or he'll run into you. Though Dominic tried to avoid him, the man wasn't paying attention and brushed against Dominic anyway. Butte leaned over to retrieve a dropped plex file. His face, bland and round, was deeply tanned. He looked soft around the chin and the belly. Definitely not military material. As the preoccupied man hurried on his way, Tuik said, Butte handles all my accounting and shipping. Don't know what I'd do without him. Inside Tuik's locked personal offices, Dominic barely noticed the treasures, the wall hangings, the artwork. I require a transport ship. Unmarked, a heavy hauler. I need to get it on board a highliner with no mention of my name. Tuik folded his splayed hands together and blinked repeatedly. A slight tick in his neck caused his head to twitch from side to side. You found a large strike, then? How much spice did you get? The squat man leaned forward. I can help you sell it. I have my connections. Dominic cut him off. Not spice. And there's no percentage in it for you. This is a personal matter. Disappointed, Tuik sat back, his shoulders slumping. All right, then. For a price, which we can negotiate, I'll find a big hauler. We will provide whatever you require. Let me contact the guild and arrange for passage aboard the next highliner. Where's your final destination? Dominic looked away. Kaitain, of course. The den of the Carinos. Then he blinked and sat up stiffly. But then that's none of your business, Tuik. No, the water merchant agreed, shaking his head. None of my business. A troubled expression crossed his face, and he distracted his guest as he shuffled papers and attended to the useless business cluttering his office. Come back in a week, Dominic, and I will give you all the equipment you need. Shall we establish a price now? Dominic turned away, not even looking at him. Charge me whatever is fair. Then he walked to the door, anxious to get back to his base. After Dominic summoned his men into the largest chamber in his base, he spoke in a somber, cadaverous voice as he described the horrors he had witnessed on Ix. Long ago, when I brought you here, I took you from your homes and your lives, and you agreed to join me. We allied ourselves against the Carinos. With no regrets, Dom, Asuyo interrupted. Dominic made no acknowledgment, but continued in his droning voice. We meant to become wolves, but instead we were only gnats. He rested his large hands on the tabletop and drew a long, slow breath. That's about to change. Without explanation, the renegade Earl left the room. He knew where he had to go and what he had to do. These men could follow him or not. It was their choice, because this was his battle, no one else's. It was well past time to bring an accounting to House Carino. He penetrated deep into the cold fortress, down dim corridors where the floors were coated with grit and dust. Few people came there. It had been years since he himself had set foot in the armored storehouses.
Don't do it, Dominic.
The whispering voice prickled the back of his head again. A chill ran down his spine. It sounded so much like Shando, his conscience trying to make him reconsider.
Don't do it.
But the time for any choice in the matter had long since passed. The thousands of years of Carino rule following the Butlerian Jihad had left a deep scar on the glorious timelines. The Imperial House did not deserve it. At the watershed of the old empire, that other renegade family, whatever their names had been, whatever their motivations, had not finished the job. Though Seleucus Secundus lay destroyed, the other renegades had not done enough. Dominic would take vengeance one step further. At the sealed doors of the deepest storage chamber, he keyed in the proper code before slapping his palm against the scanner plate. No one else had access to this vault. When the doors slid open, he saw the collection of forbidden weaponry, the family atomics that had been House Vernius's last resort, held in reserve for millennia. The Great Convention absolutely forbade the use of such devices, but Dominic no longer cared. He had nothing to lose. Absolutely nothing. After the Tleilaxu overthrow, Dominic and his men had retrieved the secret stockpile from a moon in the Ixion system and brought it here. Now he ran his gaze over the whole array. Sealed in gleaming metal containers were warheads, planet killers, stone burners, devices that would ignite the atmosphere of a world and transform Kaitain into a tiny, short-lived star. It was time. First, Dominic would visit his children on Caladan to see them one last time, to say goodbye. Before this, he hadn't wanted to risk calling attention to them or incriminating them. Romber and Kylia had been granted amnesty while he was a hunted fugitive. But he would do it just this once, with utmost discretion. It was appropriate to do that after all these years. Then he would strike his final blow and become the victor after all. The entire corrupt bloodline of the Carinos would become extinct. But the voice of Shando in his conscience was filled with sadness and regret. Despite all they'd been through, she didn't approve. "You always were a stubborn man, Dominic Vernius." Innovation and daring create heroes. Mindless adherence to outdated rules creates only politicians. Viscount Hundro Moritani. The evening after the Corridor of Death ordeal, the gathered swordmasters sat in a large dining tent with the 43 surviving members of the original class of 150. These students were now treated as colleagues, finally awarded the respect and camaraderie of fighting men. But at such a cost. Rich, cold spice beer was served in tall mugs. Off-world hors d'oeuvres lay spread on porcelain dishes. The proud old instructors were congratulatory, wandering among the rugged trainees they had shaped for 8 years. Duncan Idaho thought the students' revelry carried a hysterical tinge. Some of the young men sat in shock, moving little, while others drank and ate with wild abandon. In less than a week, they would regroup at the main island's administration building, where they still had to face a final round of oral examinations, a formal checking of the intellectual knowledge they had absorbed from the swordmasters. But after the murderous obstacle course, answering a few questions seemed anticlimactic. Released from their pent-up tension, Duncan and Resser drank too much. Over years of rigorous training, they had consumed only meager fare to toughen them up, and they had developed no tolerance for alcohol. The spice beer hit them hard. Duncan found himself growing maudlin as he remembered the struggles, the pain, and all his fallen schoolmates. What a waste. Resser reeled from his triumph, full of celebration. He knew his adoptive father had expected him to fail all along. After separating from his fellow Grumman students and refusing to quit his training, the redhead had won as many psychological battles as physical ones. Long after the yellow moons had passed overhead, leaving a wake of sparkling stars, the party broke up. The students, bruised, scarred, and drunk, wandered off one at a time, forsaking further revelry to face battles with impending hangovers. Inside the main huts, dishes and glasses were broken. Nothing remained to eat or drink. Hii Resser walked barefoot with Duncan into the island's darkness. They wandered from the big house toward the cluster of lodging huts farther down the broad white beach, their steps uneven on the rough ground. Duncan clapped a hand on his friend's shoulder in a brotherly gesture, but also to help keep his balance. He couldn't understand how the enormous swordmaster Rivi Denari managed to walk with such grace. "So, when all this is over, will you come with me to see Duke Leto?" Duncan formed his words carefully.
Remember, House Atreides would welcome two swordmasters if Moritani doesn't want you. House Moritani doesn't want me, not after Trin Kronos and the others left the school, Resser said. Duncan noted no tears in his friend's eyes. Strange, Duncan said. They could have celebrated with us tonight, but they made their own choices. The pair walked down the slope toward the beach. The sleeping hut seemed very far away and blurry. But I still have to go back there to face my family, to show them what I accomplished. From what I know of Viscount Moritani, that sounds dangerous. Suicidal, even. Nevertheless, I still have to do it. In the shadows, he turned to face Duncan, and his somber mood slipped away. Afterward, I'll come to see Duke Atreides. He and Duncan peered through the darkness, stumbling around as they tried to adjust their eyes. Where are those huts? They heard people ahead and a clank of weapons. Warning signals went off in Duncan's fogged mind, but too slowly for him to react. Ah, there! It's Resser and Idaho! A blazing light stabbed his eyes like luminous ice picks, and he raised his hand to shield against the glare. Get them! Disoriented and surprised, Duncan and Resser bumped into each other as they turned to fight back. A group of unrecognizable, dark-clad warriors fell on them in an ambush, carrying weapons, sticks, clubs. Unarmed, Duncan called upon the skills Ginaz had taught him, defending himself next to his friend. At first he wondered if this was some kind of additional test, a last surprise the swordmasters had sprung after lulling their students with the celebration. Then he saw a blade, felt it slash a long, shallow wound in his shoulder, and he no longer held back. Resser yelled, not in pain but in anger. Duncan spun his fists and feet, lashing out. He heard an arm crack, felt one of his toenails gouge open a sinewy throat. But the mob of opponents pounded Duncan's head and shoulders with stun sticks. One attacker struck the base of his skull with an old-fashioned club. With a grunt, Resser tumbled to the soft ground, and four men piled on top of him.